This is the Future of HR podcast, episode 110.
And made the argument in Eat, Sleep, Innovate that there are five behaviors that drive innovation success. And I'll quickly go through them. Behavior number one, we've already talked about, curiosity. You can't do something different that creates value without questioning the status quo. So great innovators are always looking for different and better ways to do things. And they're asking questions like, why are we doing it this way? How might we do it differently? Behavior number two is being customer obsessed. You can't create value unless you solve a problem for someone. Now, we pick the word customer there because our ideal target audience is someone who's creating a new product, a new service that's going into a market, but everybody has someone they're serving. So you might think about the business that you're advising if you're someone who's in HR, who are the colleagues that you're supporting? If you're in a supply chain function, who are the suppliers you're working with, whatever. Great innovators invest the time to understand the people they're trying to serve better than they understand themselves. Know the problems that they're trying to solve, because you solve those problems, you create value.
How can you purposely create a culture of innovation? What are the invisible barriers to innovation inside your organization? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR podcast. The only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. If you're a fan of the Future of HR podcast, then you know that I'm a big fan of Deeper Signals. Deeper Signals is a modern scientific assessments platform that is revolutionizing the way organizations measure, manage, and develop their talent. And in the age of AI, soft skills are becoming more and more crucial. And that's why their latest innovation to the Deeper Signals platform, Skills Selector, is a game changer that we've all been waiting for in soft skills-based hiring. Here's why I'm impressed with Skills Selector. Number one, it's lightning fast. You get to assess a candidate's soft skills in just 10 minutes. It's fully customizable. You can create customized job profiles that perfectly match your company's needs and your competency frameworks. It's visually intuitive. You can compare candidates side by side instantly. And it doesn't just stop at hiring. It seamlessly transitions into personalized onboarding and development plans so your new hires can hit the ground running from day one. And the best part, it's all backed by science and cutting-edge data analytics. But don't take my word for it. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod. That's deepersignals.com/futurepod. And try their core drivers assessment for free. It'll give you a sneak peek of the insights you'll gain with the Skills Selector. And they're going to give you a 14-day free trial to the entire Deeper Signals platform. Don't miss this chance to transform your hiring process. Go to deepersignals.com/futurepod today and see how Skills Selector can make your hiring smarter, faster, and more effective. Hey, everyone. I want to let you know that last week was a big week for the Future of HR podcast. October 4th was actually our 2-year anniversary of launching the podcast, and we also hit 200,000 downloads in our first 109 episodes. This is incredible, and honestly, it's exceeded all my expectations when I launched the podcast. So I want to thank you for listening to the podcast. Thank you for all your support. Thank you for sharing it with your coworkers and peers. And I want to thank all the guests who've come on the podcast to share their wisdom with all of us. It's been an incredible 2 years, and I am just getting started, and the podcast is not going anywhere. So if you love the Future of HR podcast, it's going to be around for a while, and my goal is to continue to make the podcast even better in 2025. And as you know, my mission is to develop the next generation of HR leaders. And I did that first by launching the podcast and then by creating the Next Gen HR Accelerator program. And I want to take a moment to tell you more about the Next Gen HR Accelerator program, because I truly believe it is the most comprehensive leadership development program on the market today for HR directors and managers. The reason I say that is because it's focused on building business and financial acumen. strategic thinking skills, influence and executive communication skills, and how to translate business strategy into actionable and value-added HR initiatives. And not only do next-gen HR leaders learn these skills and gain the methodologies to be effective in their roles, they also get an opportunity to grow as leaders. Every next-gen HR Accelerator participant receives 360 feedback, coaching from me, and leaves the targeted from-to development plan. And they also have the opportunity to learn more from their peers and expand their network. And in this current cohort, we included HR leaders from Nike, McDonald's, Kohler, Nationwide Insurance, Cardinal Health, and more. Our next cohort starts on January 21st, and you can register now until December 20th. I do expect us to sell out before then. So if you're interested, feel free to reach out to me directly or go to our website to learn more at nextgenhracelerator.com or go to futureofhr.com to learn more about the program or even get registered. Don't miss out on this opportunity to become a more business-focused and strategic HR leader for yourself or your team. And with that, I want to introduce this week's guest, Scott Anthony. Scott is a professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, where he teaches a course called Leading Disruptive Change, and he's a managing director and managing partner emeritus at InnoSight, a growth strategy consultancy founded by a Harvard Business School professor, Clay Christensen. Scott is also the author of 8 books and a recognized expert and keynote speaker on topics related to navigating disruptive change. Today, we're talking to Scott about his book, Eat, Sleep, and Innovate. But his forthcoming book, Decoded, How Disruptive Innovators Combine Magic, Methods, and a Bit of Madness to Change the World, is set to be a game changer, and we will certainly have him back on to discuss it in 2025. Also, Scott was recognized by Thinkers 50 as the world's 9th most influential thinker in 2023 and the world's leading innovative thinker in 2017. I'm also proud to say Scott will be leading a session at Elevate by Future of HR on leading disruptive change, which is going to be terrific. But most importantly, you're going to learn a lot from Scott today, and this is one conversation that I think you might want to share with your business leaders. As Scott says, innovation is not the job of a few, but it's the responsibility of many. In my conversation with Scott, we talked about why he defines innovation as something different that creates value, how HR leaders can purposely create a culture of innovation, why organizations need to recognize and overcome their shadow strategy that prioritizes the status quo over innovation, how to overcome organizational ghosts, which are the invisible barriers to innovation, such as past failures and ingrained behaviors, and how to embrace disciplined experimentation to foster innovation and ongoing learning, and much, much more. I'd love to hear your thoughts in this episode. As you listen, drop me a line on LinkedIn and say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Scott. Scott, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I am doing great, JP. Really glad to be here today.
Oh, we're excited to have you on the podcast to talk about innovation and your amazing career, but also your terrific book, Eat, Sleep, and Innovate. And so I want to kick it off and just talk more about your career, because you've accomplished a lot. I'm not sure you've actually slept. You may have been innovating, probably eating, but maybe not sleeping, because you've written 7 books. You're a professor at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, where you research and teach around navigating disruptive change. And of course, you're a senior advisor to InnoSight, a consultancy that you helped build and lead for many years. So you've been busy. I love that about you. But as you think about your career and your contributions, what's that common thread that sort of connects all those experiences?
There's 2 ways I can answer this question. First is a thematic one. You said navigating disruptive change. That theme really runs through everything that I do, whether it's the work that I did as an advisor for InnoSight, the things I've written about in my books, what I'm now trying to teach to students. So disruptive change, the idea that traces back to Clayton Christensen at the Harvard Business School, who was my professor 24 years ago, who was my boss for a couple of years when I was heading up his research activities, and then was my colleague as we were working to build InnoSight for many years. So that one thrust, the idea of disruption. If I think about what it is for me that has enabled these things to happen, I think it's just curiosity. I'm very curious about how things work, why they work. To Clay's question, why is it that smart, well-run companies can fail in the face of disruptive change? why some companies can overcome it, other companies struggle with it. Every book that I have written has come from a client asking me a question, a student asking me a question to which I had no good answer. I say, that's interesting. Let's go and explore that a little bit further. And the experiences I've had in life that have had the most impact have been ones where someone is presenting an opportunity to me. And I said, well, that sounds really interesting. Let's give it a try. Like when I was graduating from Harvard Business School, Clay said, I've got some research budget to hire a researcher. I guarantee you will significantly drag down the average compensation of your graduating class, but you'll learn some different things. And I said, why not? And the why not has been what has enabled me to learn some fun things and be able to share some fun things.
That's a great story, and I will definitely link out to The Innovator's Dilemma, because that is a classic book that I think all HR leaders should understand and read, right, to understand how the innovation happens. But more interesting for you, the why not question, have you always been curious? Is that something that sort of you think has been more innate for you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it is a combination like everything. There's some that's born, there's some that is shaped. What my mother would say, she had very, very clear guidance when we started having our own children about what to do to raise children. She had clear perspectives on many things, my mother. But one thing she really believed strongly in was the benefit of Montessori education for children when they're young. She said, in a Montessori program, you have all sorts of different age groups together. You have kids that are teaching kids in some cases. There is a degree of freedom with some control around it, a condition that really helps to teach a love of learning. And I've got four siblings. We all went through Montessori programs. My kids have all started in Montessori programs in early days. And I really do think it helps to create an innate love of learning. And then what has kept the flame alive? I've been very fortunate that when I have asked why not, the answers have been good and interesting and good things have happened. So I have received positive reinforcement from doing that. And here we are.
Oh, I love that. Well, definitely think curiosity is so important for all of us, because if we're not learning, we're not growing. And in this day and age, as you know, disruptive change is happening everywhere. But let's talk about your latest book, Eat, Sleep, and Innovate. What inspired you and your co-authors to write this book? And what do you hope people take away from it?
I mentioned before, almost everything I've done is a result of somebody asking a question to which I don't have an answer. And in this case, it was one of the co-authors of the book. So the co-authors of the book are, so I'm the lead author. Then there's Paul Cobbin, who was the Chief Data and Transformation Officer at DBS Bank, a leading bank in Singapore. And then former Innosight colleagues, Natalie Pinchot and Andy Parker. So Paul was the one who asked the question. I was working at Innosight at the time. I was in Singapore at the time. Paul asked me just this fantastic question. It was, can you purposefully create culture inside a company? And I said, that's a really interesting question. People know what culture is. That's been studied. But the idea of actually going and purposefully shaping it means you got to understand where it comes from. You got to understand how to change it. And there were some things that were out there on the topic, but there wasn't anything definitive on it. Certainly not about creating a culture of innovation. So I said, yeah, I think you could probably do that. And Paul created an opportunity for us to learn by doing. He had a specific problem in mind at DBS Bank. He was opening up this new development center in Hyderabad in India, and he really wanted to have a very specific culture there. So we went in the field, we experimented, some things worked, some things didn't. The next time we experimented, it was a little bit better. We learned some more things. And at some point we had learned enough that we said we ought to turn this into a book. And we turned it into a book because we said, this is a really persistent problem. You go and ask any leader of any organization, is it important for you to innovate? 100% of them are going to say yes. There's just too much stuff going on in the world today. You ask them, are you satisfied with your organization's ability to innovate? About 95% of them will say no. There'll be a few who say, actually, I feel pretty good about it. But the overwhelming majority will say, I'm struggling with this. This is after decades of work doing whatever is the latest fad that people read about, developing a culture that really goes and enables innovation continuously is a really deep, really persistent problem. So I'm very grateful to Paul for asking that question, because it started a journey that I think has proved to be quite fruitful.
Yeah, it's so important to ask those questions, because we can go on that journey. And sometimes the journey is more important than the answer. But I love how you guys tackled this. And you're right, Scott, like everyone says innovation is important. If we looked at mission statements, success profiles, values and behaviors, whatever it is, innovation is going to go across that spectrum. But so few organizations are good at this, right? And it goes back to you know, a lot of times organizations are really designed for bureaucracy. We don't mean to on purposely, but we're trying to get consistent results, which means we want to do things a certain way. Innovation is a little more messy. So talk to us more about how you define this culture of innovation and kind of what that looks like.
Yeah, so we need to do definition. So we got to start with innovation. So culture of innovation, we're talking about a specific thing. In the book, we define innovation as something different that creates value. It's a simple definition, but one that we find pretty powerful. You can break it into two pieces. Something different, the first phrase there, is deliberately open-ended. It creates space for big bang, world-changing things like hypersonic planes and life-saving vaccines and so on, but also allows room for the day-to-day things that make life just a little bit better. Both forms are important. Innovation is not the job of the few, it's the responsibility of the many. Creates value. That separates innovation from precursors, things like invention and creativity, critically important, of course. But until you take the creative spark and turn it into whatever kind of value you're trying to create, it might be revenues, it might be profits, it might be more engaged employees, whatever it is, in our eyes, you have not innovated. We channel the Edison quote, genius, he once said, is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. If you're not sweating, you're not innovating. So we've got our definition of innovation. A culture of innovation then is one in which the behaviors that drive innovation success come naturally. And I'm happy to go into more detail about those behaviors, but I'll pause before I do that because that was a long enough answer to give you space to ask me another question.
Hey everyone, after a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Scott Anthony. I'm excited to let you know that I've recently put together a succession planning playbook that you can download for free at futureofhr.com. And whether you want to assess your current approach to succession planning or you're building your leadership development strategy from scratch, this playbook offers an actionable framework designed to help you understand what great succession planning looks like. So go to futureofhr.com and download the succession planning playbook today. Yeah, I think that's great. When I worked at Lenovo, we were focused on innovation, being a technology company. At the time, we were moving to PC Plus, this idea of mobile and, you know, everything was kind of coming at us. And we had this idea of the big I and the little I, to your point, of like big innovation and little innovation. And it was the little I that I thought was even more critical, because if you're in a support function, you know, everyone can innovate and make things better and try to create value in that space, as you talked about. But it was the implementation that's so critical. And we tried to put some values out there, actually, or behaviors out there for people to say, this is what innovative behaviors look like. So I would love to hear more of what you think that looks like. So we might have tied off a little bit of that work from Clay and I think Hal Greenspan, if I'm getting that right. I may be messing up his last name.
You're very close. There was a stream of research that was done about, gosh, probably about almost 20 years ago it was started. It was Hal Gregersen, Jeff Dyer, and Clay Christensen. And it ultimately got summarized in a book, The Innovator's DNA. So we took the work from that book, combined it together with what we had learned in the field over the course of a couple decades at Innosight, and made the argument in Eat, Sleep, Innovate that there are five behaviors that drive innovation success. And I'll quickly go through them. Behavior number one, we've already talked about, curiosity. You can't do something different that creates value without questioning the status quo. So great innovators are always looking for different and better ways to do things. And they're asking questions like, why are we doing it this way? How might we do it differently? Behavior number two is being customer obsessed. You can't create value unless you solve a problem for someone. Now, we pick the word customer there because our ideal target audience is someone who's creating a new product, a new service that's going into a market. But everybody has someone they're serving. So you might think about the business that you're advising if you're someone who's in HR, who are the colleagues that you're supporting? If you're in a supply chain function, who are the suppliers you're working with? Whatever. Great innovators invest the time to understand the people they're trying to serve better than they understand themselves. Know the problems that they're trying to solve, because you solve those problems, you create value. Behavior number three. Great innovators are collaborative. They recognize that magic happens at intersections when different mindsets and skills collide. They plant themselves at those intersections, recognizing that none of us are as smart as all of us. Behavior number four, being adept in ambiguity. We understand this. Innovation is never a straight shot. Innovation is not an activity where you plan, study, and act. It is an activity where you test, learn, and adjust. There's going to be false steps, there's going to be fumbles, there's going to be failures on the path to success, and great innovators relish that journey. Finally, behavior number five, empowered. You can't do something different that creates value unless you actually do something. So, of course, innovators are pondering, they're pontificating, they're creating PowerPoint slides and so on, but they're doing everything possible to make their idea as tangible as possible, as quickly as possible, in many cases, asking for forgiveness, not permission. You do those five behaviors regularly, you do them habitually, you have a culture of innovation.
Thinking about those five behaviors, which ones do you feel that organizations, it's easier to implement and to start making a reality? And which of those are more challenging? Because individually, it might be easier for one person to do all of those things. But as a culture, how do you start to really get that to happen on a collective basis, right?
Great question. I think the easiest one for organizations to implement is customer obsession. The kind of simplistic guide that I give people to get better at customer obsession is however much time you're spending with customers, triple it. If you're spending zero, then first add something and then triple it. But that's not a hard thing to do. And this idea of let's really look at the world through the eyes of our consumer, customer, channel, employee, whatever. People get that. It makes intuitive sense. You can implement that quickly. That's something that I think is a pretty easy thing to do. Being adept in ambiguity, conceptually easy thing to do, really hard for organizations to do for the reason that you mentioned before. What does an organization exist to do? An organization exists to do what it is currently doing better, faster, cheaper, more effectively, more efficiently. Innovation is something different. It's a break from the status quo. It's an anomaly. It's the unexpected. Organizations are just not built to handle that naturally. So creating a culture where you have the psychological safety, if you draw on Amy Edmondson's research, to encourage people to go and run smart experiments and celebrate when those experiments give unanticipated results, that's just not natural and requires some real work to begin to put in place.
Yeah, and that's such a great point that really requires leaders that can embrace that ambiguity and not getting the right answer or their team making a mistake or something not being successful. When my corporate experience has always been, well, where's the plan? And we're really always trying to basically say all the risks have been thought through. Like, this is going to work. But yet we haven't really tried it. Maybe we haven't even ever done a pilot for something. But there's this expectation of perfection in organizations when really there should be an expectation for experimentation, right?
There's a couple of synapses that fire when you say that. I remember back in the Innosight days, we had a gathering once, a bunch of CEOs of companies, and we had Roger Martin, a great thought leader, in to come and chat with them. And Roger wrote the book Playing to Win with A.G. Lafley from Procter & Gamble and has done a lot of things, very smart strategist. And Roger said, I'm going to give you a trick. The trick I'm going to give you is how to sound like you're supporting innovation, but actually kill innovation inside your organization. And that is when someone comes to present something to you, say, that sounds really interesting. Prove it. Because you can't. You can't prove something that hasn't been done before. And they're going to then waste a lot of time trying to prove what is ultimately unprovable, that you could only actually demonstrate by going and doing things. It might have even been at that same summit. I don't know. But another voice echoing through my head is Scott Cook. Scott Cook is the founder of Intuit, the financial software provider, QuickBooks and TurboTax and so on. He says that the role of a leader has fundamentally changed in today's world. A leader, he says, is no longer a decision maker. Experiments are decision makers. The role of a leader is essentially to lead by letting go, to create the conditions where experiments can be run and you can figure out through those experiments what the right answer is. That's really uncomfortable for people who got promoted based on making bold decisions and being proven right to say, actually, that's not what you need to do anymore. You need to let go and make sure the experiments make decisions. But that is what is really required in today's world.
Those are such great examples that I think will help the listeners and HR leaders to talk to their leaders about this. How have you seen, Scott, then organizations that embrace that? Because as we talked about, your job, a lot of times organizations to get the same results better, faster, cheaper, more efficiently. But then if you're trying to innovate and grow, you have to have this idea of experimenting and leveraging that really to guide the path to the future. How do you think about from a leadership perspective, I guess, cultural perspective, how do you have both kind of yin and yang happening and embrace that?
Yeah. So we can spend the next 3 hours talking about just this. I will not give a 3-hour answer. Don't worry. But, let's begin to explore because it's such an important topic. I think the first thing that you want to recognize is the idea of disciplined experimentation can be something that helps you with everything. So you want to run today's business more effectively and efficiently. Actually, disciplined experimentation is your friend. You still will have uncertainty whenever you're doing anything. Finding ways to rigorously identify the biggest points of uncertainty and ruthlessly stamp them out is a good discipline no matter what you do. Now, of course, the more you're going to what you call big I innovation, the more you're going to know a little and be assuming a lot. So it's even more important in that context. So that, I think, is number one. Recognize that this specific thing is good no matter what you do. Then the second thing that I would say, and I'll stop at two things, is again, there's many more things you could say. Think about using one of the tools from the book, a tool that we call a bean, as a way to reinforce how important this is. A bean is something that we adapted from the habit change literature. It is an acronym. The habit change literature says, if you want to change habits as an adult, you have to go after what Daniel Kahneman would call system one and system two thinking. System one is the automatic thinking where you do things without being conscious about it. System two is the slow moving part of your decision-making system where you carefully consider things. The BE goes after system two. That's the behavior enabler. You're giving someone a formal ritual. You're giving them steps. You're giving them coaching. You're giving them feedback. You're helping them consciously make a change. The AN stands for artifacts and nudges. That goes after system one. You're helping people do new things without them realizing you're helping them do new things. So in essence, a bean is a reinforced ritual. And in Eat, Sleep, Innovate, the companion materials we have for it, we've got a bunch of things that can help people be better at disciplined experimentation. One of my favorite ones that I can describe pretty briefly is from the Finnish gaming company Supercell. They have a ritual called Cheers to Failure. What does that mean? They're working on new games all the time. Sometimes they succeed, a new game launches, everyone gets together, they crack open a beer, they celebrate. That's not the ritual I'm talking about here. Sometimes they admit defeat. They say, you know what? This game is never going to make it. They have a ritual. Everyone gets together, they pop open a bottle of champagne. They say cheers to failure. The champagne bottle has a blank label on it. They can write what they learned from the failure. A very powerful ritual that shows it's okay when we try something and it doesn't work. We need to continue to push the frontier. We need to continue trying. We need to continue experimenting. A lot of other examples out there, but I think that's a simple one to understand and helps to reinforce the point.
It's a great example of Supercell, what a really interesting culture and smart way to celebrate the successes and failures, because I think that's the hardest part. A lot of times people are just, it's personal. They're thinking about their careers. The leaders are like, well, hey, if we fail, what's that going to look like? So it takes really just confident leaders that are understanding, and experimentation can be that way. You also talk a little bit about the shadow strategy, and we've been talking about this a little bit more, but maybe you can explain how you think about the shadow strategy, which are the powerful forces that prioritize today over tomorrow. How can organizations overcome that besides experimentation? I mean, how do you maybe tackle this from a more cultural perspective?
Yeah, not easily. So, you know, like anything, the first part of it is recognizing that it's there. So when we use the phrase shadow strategy, what do we mean? Well, an organization will have a strategy, and a strategy will be in a document. It will say, we want to achieve this goal, and we're going to take these actions to achieve this goal. It is an intended set of activities to achieve a targeted goal. Now, the actual strategy a company follows is how it allocates its resources. It's where dollars or euros or rupees or whatever are being spent. It's where leadership is spending its time. It's where assets like manufacturing facilities and so on are being allocated. Most organizations, the way that marketers market, the way that R&D scientists do their research and development activities, the way that salespeople sell, all of that is hardwired to do what they are currently doing better, faster, more effectively, more efficiently. So even if you say, I want to do this big, bold, disruptive thing, if that's not where people are spending their time, if that's not where you're putting your money, you're going to implicitly do what you're currently doing. So I say every organization has a strategy, even if they say they don't have a strategy, that's to keep doing exactly what they're doing, because that's what the shadow strategy will do. It will perpetuate the past, even when you want to do something different. So what do you do with that? So as I said, number one, recognize that it exists. Number two, use the tool of the bean to say, how do we go and actively subvert this? Make sure that what we want to do and what we are implicitly doing come closer together. So a bean, a reinforced ritual, can be a very powerful thing to help with it. And then three, and this is where it gets far too complicated for us to talk about it in too much depth here, you have to reinforce it like crazy. So you have to make sure your budgeting mechanisms are putting money in the places where they need to be. Your leadership development programs are giving people the skills and mindsets that are consistent with the things that you're trying to do. The way in which you're measuring and rewarding people is consistent as well. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. An effort to fight the shadow strategy is only as strong as the weakest component in it. You really have to fight it at a system level. So, you know, the bean is a really, really powerful thing to start. And then you got to do all the hard work that everybody knows about to reinforce it.
Well, I appreciate you talking about that shadow strategy. I hadn't really thought of it that way. I think we've all experienced it, of where decisions are really being made in the organization, how we're putting our resources. It's always follow the money, follow the leader's time, and really see, are we really putting our money where our mouth is on that strategy we talked about? Are we really just doing the same thing over and over again?
You know, JP, I remember a moment early in my Innosight time that really stuck with me. We were at an offsite. We were probably like 20 people at this time. And we had this guy, Willie Shee, who was there watching. And Willie's a professor at the Harvard Business School after a 20-year run working at IBM, Thomson Reuters, at Eastman Kodak, where he ran some of their consumer business, which is interesting experience. So we're going through this offsite and we're listing out all these strategic priorities we're working on. We had this really long list of really exciting things. And Willie's like, how many people are in your organization again? We're like 20. And he's like, who of you are actually spending time working on any of these initiatives? And we all kind of look at each other. And he said something that just really stuck with me. Where you spend your time is a reflection of your priorities. The fact that you're not spending any time on these initiatives mean that they're just words on a piece of paper. They are not strategic priorities. So if you're not going to spend the time on it, don't tell people that it's a priority, because it isn't.
It's just true advice around strategy. A lot of times we think about, well, what really matters to us, but then look at your calendar. But Scott, I want to get a little more tactical for a moment, because, and put you in a spot to think about, you were advising a new CHRO who's been tasked with creating this culture of innovation. Where would you recommend they start, and how would they think about this big challenge?
That's a great question. I have two thoughts. So thought number one, if the organization has existed for long enough, go visit, and it has one, go visit the museum that talks about the organization's history, because in that museum, you often find seeds that enable you to think about what really is the essence of this organization that I've come into. What are the things that are going to allow us to succeed and thrive in the future, even if everything around us changes? I remember I was talking to a leader inside a big Japanese cosmetics company called Shiseido. And that's what they did when they joined. Company's 152 years old. And she said, day one, I went to the museum. And the founder of the company said something remarkable. He said, we need to change to remain unchanged. I need change to remain unchanged. And she said, that's the driver of everything that I do now. We need to keep the core heritage of the company. And to do that, we got to change everything. So understanding the past, I think, is just a really powerful way to understand where you're going to change. And then the second thing that I would suggest is to find the ghosts. So ghosts, what are ghosts? I had an article with a couple Innosight colleagues in 2023 that talked about this idea. Ghosts are the invisible, but very real and very powerful forces that inhibit your ability to do new things. This could be a trauma that happened in the organization's past that people still haven't gotten over. It might be a big product failure. It might be an M&A deal that went the wrong direction. It might be a toxic leader. Those ghosts, the trauma ghosts, are ones that will lead people to hesitate when they're doing new things. It might be invisible patterns, the sort of thing where people say, well, that's just the way that we do things around here, that they're not conscious of at all. But you coming in your job at day one, you're able to see things that other people can't. Those things can be very powerful because they perpetuate the status quo, when what you really want to do is you want to change it. And then finally, you have what I think is the scariest ghost and the one that's most prevalent today. This is a hidden identity crisis inside an organization. Brené Brown from the University of Houston says the greatest shame trigger is the fear of being made irrelevant. When you're going from one place to another, the destination might be something that is conceptually exciting, but you might have liked the way things used to work. You might have liked being the king or queen of your own domain or castle. You might have liked being an expert. And when you have to go to a new space, you have to unlearn a lot. Power dynamics shift. Your own sense of identity can be shaken. And that can lead people to say all sorts of rational reasons why they don't want to change. But actually, they're afraid. So if you can figure out as a CHRO, what are the ghosts inside your organization? What are the hidden blockers and barriers to change? You can start doing something about them. Without it, well-intended change programs will be haunted forever.
Very insightful, really, really helpful to think about that. I've always had that same philosophy of respect the past, embrace the future. It's coming to different organizations that had those long histories, but the ghost piece I had not thought a lot about. And I think that's a really great concept for us to think about. Where are those ghosts, right? They're probably lurking around us as well. Some things are holding us back at time. We all have ghosts, right? That imposter syndrome.
100%. The idea for it came from, I did a few years ago when I was in Singapore, I did a program. I was a student in a program called Executive Master in Change that was taught at INSEAD. And it was grounded in system psychodynamics, which is a big clunky term, but it basically is the intersection of business and psychiatry. And, you know, a lot of the fundamentals of the program are understanding individuals and some of the blind spots and barriers, psychoses, neuroses, et cetera, they have, and then recognize individuals, get together in groups, get together in departments, get together in bigger departments, ultimately making up organizations. So individuals suffer from things that then cascade into larger settings. If you don't understand your own blockers as an individual, you can't change. If you don't understand it as an organization, you can't change either.
Really appreciate that. You also are a little bit of a futurist, and I know you like to look around the corner, and all of us right now, frankly, are trying to look around that corner for generative AI and saying, how is that going to reshape our lives, our work, our organizations, and how that'll impact innovation in the coming years? I'd love to hear your thoughts on, and your early thoughts on how you're thinking about generative AI and impacting innovation and just our workplace.
Yeah, so the very short answer is profoundly. So the longer answer, in the spring of this year, I ran a course at Tuck, the business school at which I teach, called Generative AI and Consultative Decision Making. So about half of the people who graduate from Tuck end up going to work at consulting companies. So we said a great opportunity to essentially train future consultants into how to use Gen AI to advise clients. And it was designed a short format course. It was a sprint. So it was just four sessions over 4 weeks. And it was designed intentionally vaguely. We got some real companies to give us some real problems. We broke the students into teams and we said, you got to go and come up with a cool idea. You've got to communicate it in a compelling way. You got to tie it all together in a pitch to the company. And you're going to use Gen AI. We want you to use Gen AI for everything you do. And we gave students, you know, one or two pages of some tips, links to academic articles and popular press articles that could help them, and then let them go. The thing that really struck us at the end of it is using the worst tools that will exist for AI, because the tools just keep getting better and better, the ability to very quickly do things that used to be very difficult, and in some cases push further than you could have pushed before, is incredibly powerful. The ability to come up with creative ideas. You know, some of the early research shows the average idea generated by AI is more creative than the average human, but you don't get the big ideas. Well, you can actually get the big ideas once you learn how to do what's known as prompt engineering a little better. And that's going to disappear because the Gen AI will get better and better. Communications, if you're still communicating with a PowerPoint slide, well, you can create an animated clip like that. You're just behind the times. So you can really see for decision-making, innovation, strategy, choices, and so on, lots of ways in which AI is going to change things. The specifics are still to be written. But to me, the biggest thing I took away from this, we all need to be playing with the technology. In fact, when I stepped back from the class, what we did is create an environment where people could engage in purposeful play, that they could go and experiment, they could try things. There was no risk. The sprint format, you can't fail it. As long as you show up, you get credit for taking the class, which is great because people would then push themselves on boundaries. They try things they otherwise wouldn't try. And from that, they learned. And this cannot be a one-shot thing. I told all the students, don't stop learning about AI now. Keep learning because the tools keep changing. And if we're not fluent with it, the line that I think is getting some traction, you won't lose your job to AI. You lose your job to somebody who's using AI. And we all need to learn how to do it because it is an indispensable tool for the years ahead.
Really interesting. I think you're right. You can really experiment with AI and it can be a thought partner. I've been using Claude. A big fan of Claude and just the way that it gives responses, right? So I try to use it every day. But one thing I've been wrestling with, and so I'm just kind of going live with you, Scott, because we've been thinking about this a lot too, is as AI is getting built into everything, like with Apple coming out and with their Apple Intelligence, does AI become a little bit of a commodity in the fact that it raises all the boats with that rising tide and we're all starting to use AI in everything, whether it's Copilot, et cetera? Or do you really think this is a skill set, especially maybe on video, where you're seeing people are doing some really cool things, but it's not that easy in consumer creative tools. Like you've got to be a little bit more into how you do this. How do you see it impacting us in general versus do I have to go learn AI and specific tool sets to keep up and stay relevant?
Yeah, I think one of the things that is so good about the current versions of generative AI tools, I mean, they use natural language. So you don't have to learn how to code Python or whatever to be able to utilize them. You just have to be able to speak in whatever language you speak in. So the ability to begin to play without needing to have any specialized skills really does make it a general purpose technology that I think everybody benefits from. So I think certainly it is a tide raiser. I was talking to another business school professor yesterday at a different school, and he said, basically, students can do 3 times as much as they could before. So that's great. We ask them to come to class 3 times more prepared, not 3 times more hours spent, but just 3 times more insight. And with that, we can push further. So, you know, you now have the ability to get to that frontier and then push beyond it. So yes, I think the tide will absolutely raise. I think it then leads, interestingly, to maybe almost a renaissance of skills that have been a bit devalued over the course of the past couple of decades. You know, the general advice to parents is get your kids into STEM, keep away from things like poetry and so on. Well, I think we need a little bit more poetry now. A lot of the coding is done for us brilliantly and beautifully behind the scenes, but we need to be smart. We need to be people who can be critiques, who can go and be discerning consumers of what's coming out, prosumers if we're producing it with it. And we really need that liberal arts background to be able to have good critical reasoning skills and really think differently about what's coming out. So I wonder whether we're going to see something very different in the educational front in the years ahead, where kind of the balance shifts in a different way. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, maybe that philosophy major is going to have a comeback. People are pretty excited about that.
Yeah. As always, there's going to be jobs that are lost. There's going to be jobs that are created. AI ethicists and people who think about the philosophical implications, which are really deep and profound. You know, it's not my swim lane, but you know, you start thinking about what it means, even from the perspective of an author. I'm working on a new book now. The contract that I signed a few months ago had a new clause in it: thou shalt not use AI. And you say, okay, why? And the reason for the publisher is they don't want there to be copyright infringement that I do without realizing it. And then I say, well, you know, my comparative advantage historically has been I can write a lot of words pretty quickly, but I mean, I can't write as fast as ChatGPT can write. I hope they're still better, but for how much longer? I don't know.
Well, Scott, last question for you is, what's one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
So the phrase I would suggest is through the fog, through the fog. Why do I say through the fog? There was a moment that stuck with me a couple of years ago. I was at the Consumer Goods Forum, which is a meeting of the good and great in the consumer goods industry in Dublin, Ireland in 2022. Alan Jope at the time was the CEO of Unilever, and he got on stage and gave an interview. And the interviewer was asking him about, you know, the crisis of the day, which was supply chain crisis, and there was a looming conflict in Ukraine and so on. And so, you know, how does it feel to lead in unprecedented times? And Alan said, you know, I'm kind of tired of leading in unprecedented times. Can't we just lead in precedented times for a while? Everybody laughs. 4 months later, he loses his job, because the reality of today's world is we will live in the forever normal of constant change. A fog has descended upon us. And in that fog, our natural human tendency is to want to slow down. We don't know what the right answer is. Change keeps coming at us. Technologies advance exponentially. As humans, we want to stop, but we can't. We have to find ways to turn today's ambiguity into tomorrow's opportunity to speed up when that fog descends. And I think HR plays an indispensable role in doing this, helping to make sure that you have the right people with the right mindsets in the right environment that can be comfortable with the discomfort that we all face these days. So again, my phrase is through the fog.
Scott, that is brilliant. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. The book is Eat, Sleep, and Innovate. And this was an incredible conversation. I really appreciate you being on.
Thanks, JP. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Scott for sharing his insights from his book, Eat, Sleep, and Innovate, and how to make innovation a part of your culture. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, be sure to subscribe, share a podcast with at least one other person, or even better, leave a review on Apple or Spotify podcasts. This really helps us to grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. And we'll be back next week with Stephanie Lulick, CHRO of Mondelez International. Stephanie is a world-class CHRO, and we're going to talk to her about her career development philosophy and the decisions that have shaped her amazing career. We'll also discuss why she believes in investing and taking a chance on high potential talent and her secrets to a successful onboarding as a CHRO or HR leader. This is a great conversation with a great CHRO and one you will not want to miss. Thanks again for listening to the Future of HR and being part of our community.